The following program deals with military and veteran issues. All comments and opinions expressed on this show are those who made them. They do not reflect the opinions of the Church of Satan or Radio Free Satan. So on with the show.
Welcome to the official Infernal Legion podcast, the Wicked Warrior of the Month edition for June of 2020. My co-host Dwayne isn't here right now. He had another tragic masturbatory accident. He'll be back soon. Hopefully he'll pop in while the episode's still going on. But in the meantime, I have with me, as always, our lovable producer, Warlock Jeff Ivins. Jeff, how the hell are you, man?
I'm doing good.
All right. And of course, because we are doing a Wicked Warrior of the Month podcast, we have with us the Wicked Warrior for the month of June 2020, none other than Lieutenant Greg Willington. Welcome to the show, sir. How are you?
Thank you. I'm well. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's exciting not only to have on the podcast our first officer, but also our first officer who's still serving.
Mm-hmm.
So this is going to be an exciting moment. I'm hoping that you'll have a little, I guess you could say, perspective of what the new Army is like compared to what us old fucks went through. But you know what? Let's get right down to brass tacks. Let's talk about how you decided to join the Army.
Yeah. So it was a pretty gradual process for me. So, like, I didn't get in until I was 24. So I know, like, most people that join the Army tend to get in when they're 17, 18, 19. But for me, it was something I did post-college and post, like, my first post-college job when I was doing investment stuff. Not really important. But it gradually kind of dawned on me from just talking to friends and family that were in the Army, especially the Army Reserve, that it was something I really wanted to challenge myself with it. And be able to, part of it was getting into physical fitness more and wanting to be able to use physical fitness in a career, but not on a full-time basis. So that led me to kind of doing reserve or guard. As I looked at my uncle, actually retired recently from active duty Army as an officer, a lot of his stories about his career inspired me as well. And it all just came together for me to both make a civilian career change where I could get my degree paid for through ROTC. And then also get into the part-time status of military in the reserve as well. So it's kind of a long combination of factors where it all came together at the right time in 2017.
Well, that's fortunate when things just kind of, I guess you could say, magically coalesce like that. But all right, so because a lot of our members in the Legion are former enlisted or current enlisted, I think there's a big divide in the military, not like in the field, but in general between officers and enlisted. A lot of officers don't, unless they were prior enlisted, don't understand what, you know, how the enlisted guys got into it and how that whole process works for them, what basic training was really like. And a lot of enlisted guys have no concept of what being an officer entails and what you guys go through. So you mentioned you went through the ROTC process. Talk to us about that. What is the Reserve Officer Training Corps like to go through?
Yeah. So first I was looking at enlisting until I learned more about ROTC and decided to do that route. So I actually had a slot to go be a 11 November horizontal construction engineer until I got the ROTC scholarship. So anyway, I interviewed with the recruiting officer who actually was based like in the local university, which is the same one I went to for undergrad here in upstate New York. And he walked me through the process of the how long the contract was in terms of the scholarship that you get, the requirements to maintain with GPA and like majors that they wanted people to go into and everything. And from there, I was accepted pretty quickly just based on my undergrad academic average. This was going for my master's, actually, when I did this. And the first thing I had to do in ROTC, because I was coming into it so late, like most people get into it when they're 18 as like college freshmen, but I had to complete it in only 2 years. So they sent me to what's called ROTC Basic Camp, which is in, that's down in Fort Knox, Kentucky, which is where Cadet Command is based in general. And it's like a very I have not been through basic myself, but this is, I know the design of basic camp is made to give future officers that haven't been through basic something that is like a shortened version of the experience as much as they can in 1 month. So we had drill sergeants and everything. Like, we lived in like barracks with bays, and we had drill sergeants were the instructors for the whole thing. We got smoked all the time. Did a lot of the usual stuff of like rifle marksmanship, gas chamber, PT every morning, FTXs and everything. But it was all with different cadets from all over the country. And then on campus, the schedule for it was like we all had our different college majors that we'd be doing classes in, like a normal college student. But we had PT 3 times a week, 6 in the morning, ruck marches periodically. That would also be at like 4 in the morning. You'd do them before class. Military science classes 3 times a week. And then sometimes extra events, like we'd have an FTX each semester where we'd go to our nearest military base, which was Drum for my case, for those.
Oh, yeah, Fort Drum. I lived there for about 4.5 years, so that's a piece of shit place.
The winter there just lasts forever, because we'd be there in, like, September for fall FTX, and then spring FTX would be in, like, late March, and it would still just be, like, snow over the whole thing.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Yeah.
Your boots are like frozen. Yeah.
I've tried to tell people, like, when I first arrived at Fort Drum to check in, the reception sergeant that was waiting for me, I asked him, you know, hey, sergeant, do you have any advice, you know, for Fort Drum in general? Because every military installation, and even within the same branch, is different from others. They all have their different tricks and their different people you need to know and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me dead in the eye and got super serious and said, wear a sock over your junk. And I had no idea what he meant until, like, it was like, you know, 2 or 3 weeks later. And someone that was in formation with us, we were going for one of Fort Drum's famous, you know, 8 mile runs. And dude got frostbite on his balls.
Mm-hmm. I am not surprised with being Drum. Damn.
So yeah, that place is the armpit of the army, I'm convinced. Yeah. All right, sorry to interrupt. Continue with your story.
Oh yeah, no worries. No, Drum's always worth griping about. But yeah, so what is it? So base ROTC cadets, we get to be normal college students most of the time, but then we have basically 3 days a week where most people keep wearing their uniform all day because you have military science class. People just don't change and wear it throughout the day. We have lab on Fridays where we do just various like tactics and first aid and comms and everything. So we actually get to practice skills then. And a lot of the leadership development of it is as you become a third and then a fourth year cadet, you get to do increasingly leadership roles. So like we do all of the roles of like team leader, squad leader, platoon sergeant, platoon leader. And then the seniors actually get to be like the battalion commander and battalion staff. And you get into practice with just leading fellow cadets, actually planning the FTXs yourself. You hold training meetings to really get into more of that battalion level organization and leadership that officers get into very quickly. Like I was the S4 for 2 semesters. So yeah, practice doing that aspect of it. That was a really hard job, honestly. And that's a lot of the basics of how we learn. Oh, and then big commissioning requirement is between junior and senior year, you go to advanced camp. So that's also at Knox, but that's like 30 days where most of it you're out in the field just doing tactics like all day and just rotating through everyone. You have to do a rifle qual and like a PT test and stuff, but the bulk of it is just doing various missions in the field and getting evaluated on it. And that's kind of the big final requirement for graduating ROTC.
Interesting. Now, is that the basic and advanced officer courses, is that similar to like OCS or the officer candidate school? Or is that like the new name for it? Or I don't know how that works.
I think from what when I talked to lieutenants this year who commissioned through OCS, I think it's pretty similar. A difference with OCS is that I believe they still have their drill sergeants with them for that. I can't speak for OCS personally. But yeah. For us, when we went to advanced camp, it was just cadre from various active duty units all over the country. Like, we'd have like a captain, a lieutenant, and like a sergeant first class would be like our cadre for our little like training platoon, and gotcha. They'd be evaluating us.
Okay, interesting.
I think it's OCS is a different thing than ROTC though.
Right, right. All right, so back to the schools. Now, we mentioned before we started recording, I had mentioned the military academies, which most people are pretty familiar with, the Air Force Academy and the United States Military Academy and the Naval Academy and so on and so forth. And I know that officers who are going through that through those programs, they have the opportunity to take, towards the end of their terms, they have the opportunity to take special courses, like they can get their airborne wings, or they can go to Air Assault School or Pathfinder. Did you have any of those opportunities open to you in ROTC?
Yes, very much. Our school got a lot of Air Assault slots because our professor of military science, who's like, he's a lieutenant colonel, he's like the commander of a ROTC unit at a school, he had a very good relationship with an officer in the Air Assault School up in Drum. So okay. there was, and also with so much of the 10th Mountain deployed while I was in school, there was a lot of opportunities for like walk-on slots for it.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, yeah.
So a lot of cadets got to go to that. I personally didn't. Then our school would get like one airborne slot per year that our commander would assign to like the cadet with the best grades in PT, basically.
Right, right. Which is smart, because airborne will break you if you're not ready for it. Mm-hmm. It's a largely unnecessary skill to have, but they still like the hardest people to go through it. So.
It is possible for cadets to get pre-ranger slots. I don't know if it's still possible to get ranger slots, but I know from like West Point, at least in years past, kind of like the height of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, yeah. West Point cadets could actually have a rare chance to go to Ranger over like the summer.
I think that was there was, especially for like the combat arms, like infantry and artillery and things like that, they had priority status because they wanted the, no offense to you, sir, they wanted the butter bars to walk in with the tab so that the soldiers would respect them or whatever.
Oh yeah.
let's talk about that now. So you got, You graduated college, you got your commission, and you're a military police officer.
Yes.
Did you decide on that, or was that kind of assigned to you?
That I actually got to choose. So okay. In ROTC, if you're going Guard or Reserve, a nice thing is you do just get to pick your officer branch. There's a, when you are in like your senior year in the fall semester, you get this massive list that the HR people at your school give you. That is like all of the units in the country with open slots for second lieutenants in the Guard and Reserve. And then you just pick one that's the branch you want, and you can go to that.
Oh, nice.
As long as it's like, it has to be, you know, you want it to be in like a decent distance of like where you live and stuff, because you're reserve.
Sure, but yeah.
If you are, the active duty folks, that's very different for them. They rank all of their branches first through last of most desired. And then you get assigned one based on your performance at camp, GPA, PT. If you do sports, you get extra points for that. Any extracurriculars, you get extra points. And then some branches are more competitive. Like, everyone wants aviation, so aviation's hard to get. No one wants Chem Corps, so Chem Corps is easy to get. Like that.
Nice. Well, that's really cool. You got to pick your branch, because that's That's something that a lot of officers always moaned about that I served with. They're always like, how the hell did I end up in artillery? Why the fuck am I in artillery?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't blame them, because artillery is a son of a bitch. So obviously you have to complete your college courses, and you have to complete whatever ROTC requirements they are. And like you said, you had the basic and the advanced officer training programs. And then I'm assuming, unless something's changed, you have to go through the officer's version of AIT, which is learning your job. What was that experience like?
That was fun, mostly fun. It's called Basic Officers Leaders Course now, BULIC. It used to be called OBC until a couple years ago. The generals change the names all the time, whatever. But BULIC was pretty fun. So that was at Fort Leonard Wood, which is the home of the MP Corps. And all of us LTs all lived in the same hotel together. We all had our own rooms. And then we'd go to class. We had PT always at 06. And then we'd have class during most of the day. A lot of classroom studying, fair amount of homework of like writing essays and reading books and stuff. And then a fair amount of time in the field actually using the Humvees and going and doing like typical MP missions of like cordon and search and convoy protection and stuff like that. And we did the law enforcement stuff too with using the police cars. We had to get tased. We had to get OC sprayed. A lot of that kind of cop stuff.
I've seen some fun drills. I wasn't an MP, but I did go through civilian police academy. I've watched some of the videos of the MP training, and they do some stuff that the civilians don't do. And of course, the civilians do some stuff that the MPs don't do. But one of the drills I saw was, I believe he was an E3, who was in AIT, but he was reclassing from another MOS. And the they're not drill sergeants, but the AIT instructors, basically, for military police course, wanted him to earn it before he was allowed to continue training. So mm-hmm. he had to run in his full MP getup, like what you would see the MPs at a gate for a military base in. He had to run from that to like a fight scenario, break up a fight. Then he had to run from that and get hit like in a like football style things with, you know, guys with giant pads were ramming into him. And then he had to run from that and he had to shoot a shotgun. He had to run from that, break up another fight. He had to run from that, get maced and handcuff somebody, run from that, shoot his pistol, so on and so forth. And they were just drilling this guy so hard, and he looked like he wanted to die. And and I remember thinking to myself, like, that's pretty fucking hardcore.
that's worse than what we did. We for like, oh, that's brutal though. Like, we for OC spray, we had to go through, I think there was 4 stations of people, I want to say.
Okay.
So it was like, there was like a takedown, then it was 2 people pushing at you with pads. You had to take out your like foam baton and like beat them back for a little bit. Another, like a different one of the mock drill takedowns. And then the last person had like a gun. So you had to like point your gun at them, get them to drop it and lay on the ground, and then come up and like handcuff them and then radio your like location and situation. And then you were good. Mm-hmm. But that felt so freaking long. Ugh.
So you get through your officer training course for the MP and you get to your unit. Now, since you're in the reserves, units work a little differently than they do in active duty. So what was it like reporting to your unit for the first time? Was it a drill, or did you go in like on an off day and meet with the readiness NCO, or how did that work?
So the first day was actually doing a range, which was kind of just jumping right into things. Mm-hmm. That was back in, this was just November 2019 was when I had my first drill with the unit. So that was, usually our drills are 2 days on a weekend, but this was a 4-day because we had to go to West Point to shoot at a range. Okay. So I just jumped right into like being convoy commander. We drove there, and then I was range OIC like the whole time on the rifle range.
Okay.
So that it was hard because that was like my first time meeting. I talked to my commander on the phone, and that was pretty much it. I talked to him like right before Bullock. Everyone else, though, like meeting my platoon sergeant and squad leaders and everything, was just like immediately that day as we were doing stuff. Right.
I've always noticed that feels like that too with young officers when they come in. It's like one day they don't exist and the next day they're there, and of course they have a massive responsibility. And so everyone, as they walk through like the ranks of soldiers, everyone's like, "The fuck is this guy?" did you get any of that, like that kind of air of like, oh man, like these people don't know me, but I have a job to do, but they don't know who the fuck I am.
I definitely had a sense of that a little bit, especially with like the unit I came into haven't had LTs for a while actually, because they just haven't had new LTs coming in to like fill the slots, because it's harder for reserve and guard units to like fill all of the slots they're supposed to have, because they don't just get them like involuntarily assigned where they're needed. So it was very different for everyone, because like me and the other 3 LTs just like all came in on the same month. The commander had been the only officer in the company. So I think that was a pretty big thing for everyone, yeah.
Obviously, you rose to the challenge because you're still here. You're still in. You know, so. what is the... I know the infantry and like the special operations branches, they get a lot of sexy clout because of the kind of stuff that they do. But I've always noticed that MPs tend to carry a lot more equipment than any of those guys. So what is a typical range like for the MPs? Considering, I mean, you have to use what you have, your sidearm, which is your main weapon in most cases, and your rifle. And then I think most of them use shotguns as well as like Mark 19s and 50 cals and things like that, crew serve weapons. Do you guys do all that at once on the range, or are you just kind of focus on what you're doing at that time? Like, oh, we're going to qual on rifles this weekend and so on and so forth.
More like the latter, like that range. That was just like my range was the rifles, and then another LT was the OIC for a pistol range. But we, in April, we were supposed to do a range for all of the crew serves, but then Corona fucked that up, so we couldn't do it. But we were going to have a weekend of doing the Mark 19s, the M2s, 249s, 240s, all at once.
Mm-hmm. Those are the best weekends, by the way.
I know. I only got Bullocks the only time I've gotten to actually shoot crew-served weapons.
Mm.
But yeah, that's fun. But yeah, no, it is, I'm not going to lie, it's kind of nice as an MP how much firepower you're able to have in an MP platoon.
Yeah, it's like people don't really, I think about it, but MPs have such a diverse job on the battlefield. Everything from, you know, maintaining law and order within the ranks to doing patrols, whether security or combat, to guarding ECPs, to training local forces, police departments. It's such a diverse group of responsibilities that you guys kind of have to have access to that amount of firepower. But people don't think about that when they think of the MPs.
It seems like most people, especially in like active duty, just see the MPs in like the gate guard and like law enforcement capacities.
Yeah, for the most part, even overseas, like we had inner perimeter patrols that were done by MPs, but that's basically just a roving security guard patrol. Mm-hmm. And then we had the ECPs. And occasionally we'd have a convoy come through where MPs had been the convoy security. But other than that, we didn't have really any interaction with the MPs on the battlefield. Now, mind you, back in the States, at Drum, they were everywhere, you know, and they were doing basic, you know, cop duties. So, of course, you know, there's all the songs, you know, MP, MP, don't arrest me and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
but, yeah, there is definitely a kind of... You're kind of in a weird situation being a young officer and also an MP. Like, the rest of the military kind of hates you.
Yeah, I've thought of that. I know. Going into the MPs, I knew it was not the most popular branch of the Army with, you know, within it. But I was very drawn to it still, though, the more I learned about it, especially talking to, like, I was a cadet, I was in simultaneous membership program where I drilled with like a different reserve unit at the same time.
Okay.
So some of the guys in there that were like cops and former MPs and had changed jobs and stuff just talked a lot about their experiences with it. And I thought, to me at least, it sounded like the branch that let you do a lot of combat arms type roles and missions, but you can't actually be combat arms in the reserve. And I didn't want to switch to guard.
Right.
Also, I didn't want to go all the way to being infantry. So being able to do some of that stuff appealed to me a lot with it being MP. And just the more diverse mission set of it was really interesting to me.
Yeah. If you don't mind me asking, because you had a lot to consider when going this route. You could have gone active duty, you could have gone reserves, could have gone National Guard. You
mm-hmm.
could have gone into other branches if you really wanted to. I guess first and foremost, why the Army and then why the Reserve specifically? Like, what was it that set it apart from the National Guard that interested you?
So the Army, because out of all the branches of the U.S. military, I liked the Army because it was ground forces that implied more danger and like getting dirty and stuff than a lot of the Air Force and some Navy roles. Not that there's obviously not danger implied in those as well, but more in the thick of things lately. Mm. And also that the Army was a much bigger, compared to like the Marine Corps then, the Army to me looked like the much bigger organization with like more potential for getting the job you want and promotion and everything. That was what I read on forums and stuff even before I picked. So I was like, the Army seems like the better way to go if you want to progress far in it. And then Reserve, compared to Guard, I like the options to more easily live anywhere in the Reserve, with it being federal versus state. And I knew I wanted to do a civilian career where, honestly, I could make more money and live in anywhere I want in a city and not be tied to a military base and stuff. So that's why I went Reserve.
Well, that makes sense. I guess I'd never really thought about that, but if you're going to go for, especially like a corporate-level job or something, there's a lot of moving required in that. And the Reserves would offer a lot more freedom in that reign than the Guard. So that makes a lot of sense. Yeah,
that's what I thought.
So speaking of civilian careers, did you have, when you went into college and you were doing the ROTC, so you have the military police, you have whatever your degree program was. What was your degree program, by the way?
So I got my master's in business administration, and then that had a concentration in marketing.
Okay. Did you have any designs on a civilian career you wanted to spin that off to, like corporate security, for example, or something like that nature?
I was interested in either marketing or business-to-business sales pretty quickly, especially getting into the management of them with being able to use the MBA and the officer experience to leapfrog into management roles more quickly.
Gotcha. Okay. Very cool. And has that worked out for you?
Pretty well, especially considering that the world's kind of fucked up by a pandemic. Not too bad. Like, the job I was going to start, like, earlier this year got, you know, deleted by coronavirus. But what I'm doing now with doing copywriting for a recruiting company, that's going pretty well. And it can transition pretty well into some of the marketing jobs that I more specifically want to get.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad that's working out for you. Because that's a lot of work for nothing to happen, you know? Mm-hmm. So, let's go back to the military. I know you went to the range, but what is the average, like, day like at a drill in the reserves?
So we do PT. We do an APFT every single drill because of just the rotation that there's always some people that need it.
Sure. Yeah.
And then from there, we get right into some people. We kind of divide up a lot. So like my platoon, some people will immediately have to go do like admin S1 stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of us, the different, usually different squad leaders, their team leaders, will be teaching different classes. So like we'll do everything, usually PowerPoint and notes first, then we'll move outside with the trucks and so go set up like a checkpoint and role play with people driving through it and everything and all that kind of security checkpoint stuff, just for example. Mm-hmm. With it being the reserve, unfortunately, sometimes quite a bit of time gets eaten up by the admin stuff because with only having 1 weekend a month for us to all come together, we don't have the time that active duty units do for people to just get their admin stuff done during the work week because people live all over and they're not using the Army as their full-time job.
Right.
So that eats into our training time more than I'd like. But yeah, we do training on just various mission essential tasks of MPs, sometimes more general combat life-saving stuff or like break out the radios and practice those. We always have to inventory PMCS all the vehicles. Do that every single drill. Pretty normal stuff like that, I think. We just have to be really, really economical with our time to get a lot done in only 2 days.
Right, right. That makes a lot of sense because you have to do essentially what the active duty has all year to do. Let's say they have all month to do. You have to do it in a single weekend. And then, like you were saying, you add on to that the admin responsibilities and vehicle PMCSs and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
It's a daunting task, it feels like, to fit all of that, a whole month's worth of activities into a single weekend.
It is. And, like, a lot of that stuff's a pain. Like, it makes sense why there are the really high expectations now, especially since 9/11, I think, raised a lot of how much the expectations are on readiness for Guard and Reserve as far as like health status, and about all that stuff, right? So it makes sense from like a national defense point that like reserve units can be ready to deploy, you know, within 30 days of getting mobilized and everything.
Right.
But
because in a lot of cases, they, especially the MPs, as an excellent example, were deploying more than some active duty forces in the early days of the war. I don't know if that's true anymore, but in the early days of the war, that's certainly what they were doing. I know that both times that I deployed to Iraq, we replaced the National Guard unit doing the same AO that we were going to take over. And the first one was really bad because we were in Baghdad and they were from New Orleans, Louisiana, and Katrina hit right after we had arrived. Mm. And so these guys were leaving what had been extended into, I believe, a 20-month deployment. They were headed back home to take up active duty roles as the guard in their own neighborhood, and most of them couldn't contact their families, didn't know where they were or anything like that. So it was a rough time for them. And it's a lot of considerations like that that people don't think of when they come to the Guard and Reserves. Like in the active duty military, you know, your spouses, 9 times out of 10, there's always rare exceptions, but 9 times out of 10, they're living on base. The family readiness group from the unit is right there with them. They meet probably every week. They can help each other out. But in the Guard and Reserves, it could be all over. I mean, some people might be in another state altogether.
Right, you know? Right.
So, yeah, that's a tough situation. Speaking of deployments, obviously you haven't had the chance to go yet, but has your unit deployed previous to you getting there?
Yes. Their most recent deployment was to Gitmo, doing detainee operations.
And they've done that multiple times. Stories to tell about that?
We did a little bit. I have to be careful with some of it I talk about.
Sure,
it's still being
in.
But a lot of positive stuff to say about the deployment, honestly. Housing and like the overall living arrangements at the base there are like pretty good, actually. It's a Navy base, so like the standard of living, I think even for a junior enlisted, I think is pretty good. And it's a deployment also where like your family can literally visit you there, because like there's a civilian hotel there, so like you can have a family member just like fly in and you can literally visit them.
That's about a hardship deployment, right?
right. And it has major challenges as well as far as taking care of the detainees and their behavior and everything. But it sounds like I'm pretty interested in doing it at some point. Like, I kind of hope we do again in the next couple of years so I can go. But, yeah.
All right, hold on 1 second. I want to welcome back my furry co-host, Dwayne Burns. Welcome back, man. Is your wrist okay?
My wrist is awesome.
No, all right, is your dick okay?
You bastard. This is why I didn't answer that question that Patrick put up. Patrick put up a question, one of our German friends in the COS. He said, I'm a, and write down the 3 things that are at the bottom of the thing. I'm not doing it. You guys.
Yeah, because it would have been chronic masturbator, I'm sure.
No, actually, it wasn't.
All right. So just to catch you up there, Dwayne, we are talking to Lieutenant Greg here about his unit's deployment. He wasn't with them for this, but his unit did a recent deployment to Guantanamo Bay, and that's what we're talking about at this moment. So continue. I'm sorry. Continue, sir.
So other things they mentioned, there's these, I can't remember what they were called, banana rats, I want to say, something like that are like these rodents that live on Cuba that are like these massive rat-like things, and they just live everywhere on the island. So like you'll be walking back from the gym or something at night, and they said you'd look off from the sidewalk into just kind of like the wood line, and you would just see like all these little pairs of like glowing eyes staring at you. they're just everywhere, and they like, you drop anything, they'll eat it instantly. Like they're a big thing on the island.
So kind of like us in Iraq with camel spiders.
Oh yeah,
or the feral dogs that ran around.
No. Coconut crabs in Guam.
Ah.
Can you eat those?
No.
No.
I kind of want to try, yeah, though. Because huh? I mean, coconut and crab, that's like two of my favorite things. But anyway. So, interesting. You guys went to, or your unit had gone to on a deployment to Guantanamo Bay. And that brings up the question of corrections versus, I believe the term for, like, I think it's 31 Bravo is just military police. There's two separate enlisted specialties in the MP Corps for that. And then you get into higher things like investigator and things like that. But is your unit a corrections unit, or is it, I guess you could say, a straight-up military police?
We are actually a combat support unit.
Okay.
So, like, we don't have police cars. All we have is the we have Humvees and ASVs, and then we're getting the new – I just blanked on the name – the vehicle that's replacing the Humvees, the next-generation combat vehicle. I forget the name right now. But we're getting those.
Absolute shit, yeah.
I don't know. I got to sit in one at Bullock. They seem pretty nice, at least from, like, the little test model I got to sit in. But
nice.
Anyway, though, like, we're combat support. So basically, though, there are not a lot of combat support missions right now with our footprint, right, as the U.S. just being so much smaller right now. So a lot of reserve units that are even combat support are going through rotations at Gitmo. It's pretty normal.
Interesting. So if you take and being the platoon leader, I'm sure, I mean, obviously the MP officers kind of have an overall view of things, and they can lead regular MP units, combat support units, investigative units. Some of them even work with CID and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. But understanding what your soldiers are going through, is it a difficult process to teach, let's say, a 31 Bravo how to be a 31 Echo? Do you have issues running into that, or?
I can't really speak on the detainee ops much because I have not personally, like, I haven't personally deployed on it myself.
Sure. Yeah.
In Bullock, we definitely did. So we did missions where, like, in the FTX, where we actually had to, like, deal with detainees significantly and set up, like, detainee collection point and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of my sergeants really do know more about the detainee stuff than me because they've actually done it in real life, right, just in 2018. So I haven't done too much of that yet myself. A lot Bullock, the stuff we spent the most time on was definitely the combat support type missions, which I think is maybe partly because that was where our instructors' experience had mostly been as MPs, but that was where a lot of the focus was the combat support role.
That sounds a lot like they'd have you in a almost like a QRF role.
Yes.
For convoys and stuff. That sounds like more the role you would play. Or if
you were in a combat zone, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That is a lot of it. And the captains that were instructed.
Go ahead, sir. I'm sorry.
Oh, the captains at Bullock, they said, like, they'd done missions of, like, cordon and search where either, like, usually they'd be with an infantry company, would, like, cordon off, like, the outer perimeter of, like, a village, and then they would have to go in and find, like, a high-value target and actually, like, apprehend them. So stuff like that, yeah.
I've always wondered I've done a lot of interesting things since I got out of the Army and been in a lot of interesting roles, but I've always wondered how one gets hired to be an actor at those up for kind of, you know, stateside training things. Because I would love to just run around like, blah, 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 and pick out some new soldiers.
Well, there's a lot of our special forces that grow their beards out and shit when they're over there in Iraq, and they look just like them.
Yeah. Well, that's the idea.
Put a robe on, and I'm saying they could be your practice people. You don't need actors.
Given that you're in the reserves and not the guard, I know that like I was mentioning earlier, there's a lot of different things in the MP Corps that an officer can do, just in general. They can be assigned in any one of the different types of roles that MPs or MP cousins kind of play. Is that opportunity still available to you? Like, could you find yourself in a position where you're in charge of a CID unit, or is that something that's not open to the reserves?
There are CID units in the reserve, actually, so I could do that, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if I want to. I'm not closed off from the idea. I just don't know yet. We had some CID instructors that came in and taught us some of the forensics and like crime scene investigation stuff and talked what CID is like. But there are officers in it. A lot of them are warrants as well.
Mm-hmm.
So like especially a lot of the specialists that are like a blood spatter analyst or something really specific like that, they'll be like a warrant officer that gets that like subject matter expert.
Right. I'm guessing a lot of the NCOs would be the ground and pound agents like you'd see on TV. And then officers would be the guys. It'd be the angry captains from the old Lethal Weapon movies yelling at the guy.
Well, I was just going to say the warrant officers, that makes sense. Like you've seen the general's daughter.
Mm, yeah.
Travolta and the female that played in there were both warrants.
Right.
And they were CID. It always cracked me up that they could be any rank they wanted. He was a first sergeant in that movie. He was he was.
Yeah, it changed, and so did his awards. If you notice, his ribbon rack got smaller and bigger as
time, right.
things have changed. speaking of warrant officers, do you have any in your current unit?
We do not. I interacted with quite a few at Bullock who were just there actually doing CID classes, but in my own unit, we don't.
I was curious to know if they ever showed up for drill, because I know in active duty, you can never find a warrant officer. All right, so let's shift gears entirely. Let's talk about Satanism.
Yes.
How did you discover Satanism? Like, how old were you? Where did you come across the Satanic Bible? And tell us the story about all that.
So it's very lame and very 21st century. I learned about it on Wikipedia first. And
a wonderful place to get information.
Right, and especially about Satanism.
So unfortunately, I didn't like find the Satanic Bible in like an occult bookshop, you know, one magical day or anything like that. It was literally just reading it on Wikipedia, and then I ordered it on Amazon. But I was 16 at the time. And when I read about it on Wikipedia, because I got down on Wikipedia from reading about paganism first and then just through going through links got to it. And I found it the most interesting out of any religion I'd ever read about. Like, I was an atheist at the time and just didn't believe in, like, anything supernatural or gods or anything. And then once I actually got the Satanic Bible, read it, just immediately was like, yeah, I'm on board with this. This is what I've always believed. Makes sense. And, yeah.
Well, see, that right there just goes to show that Wikipedia is not all bad.
No.
All right, so you've read the Satanic Bible. You're 16 years old. You said you've read the Satanic Bible. You're like, oh, this is it. This is the shit right here. I understand this. This is exactly what I feel and believe. Where did the Church of Satan come into play after that?
Oh, I went to – let me back up a little bit. I looked at – that was actually after Wikipedia. I looked at the site next while I was waiting for the Satanic Bible to actually arrive. So I literally under like the little theory and practice tab on the – churchofsatan.com, I read like literally everything in it. And that I was like, oh yeah, no, this makes sense to me. I liked the idea that you're not really forced to go anywhere or interact with other members more than you want to, but that there is.
Yeah, that's really nice, isn't it?
It is. I've met some great members, but there have been some I don't really want to ever talk to again. But and that's perfectly fair. Some of them don't like me either, so that's what it is.
Right. Yeah, I think that's definitely for me, and I don't know how Jeff and Dwayne feel about it, but for me that's definitely a tipping point too. Like, there's a lot of, obviously, you know, we're doing this whole Infernal Legion thing. The four of us are here talking, and this is wonderful because it's a bunch of vets talking. You know,
talking shit.
But there are some people I just never want to meet or interact with whatsoever in any way. And if this was like a congregational religion, I don't think I'd have any part of it.
No.
So you're 16. Obviously, the Church of Satan does not allow members under the age of 18 in the United States. Was it just a waiting game? Did you know you were going to join when you turned 18? Or was it still a while before you decided to take that plunge?
No, I wanted to join immediately. Like, if I was able to, I would have joined when I was 16. Right. So then it was my freshman year of undergraduate college. I just set aside $200 for my lifeguarding job and then got that, like, a few days after I turned 18.
Nice. Yeah. See, let that be a lesson to people out there, because I hear people all the time bitch about the what is it now, $225, I think.
$250 went up a little bit. Inflation. $250.
Yeah. So $250. One time out of your entire life, you pay $250, and you're a member of the Church of Satan. And people are always, oh, that's such a high price tag. Get a fucking paper route. You can pay it off in like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Right.
They don't understand all the web support and everything else it takes.
Yeah. Yep.
Right. Or just, I mean, just the time. Obviously.
Well, time as well, yes.
Yeah, you got your master's in business. You understand time is money. Mm-hmm. and the time that it takes for someone to read over your application, check you out, make sure you're not, you know, some douchebag. And then
they could be charging you an extra fee to do a police check on you.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, $250 once in your lifetime is a really small price to pay to be a member of anything, whether it's a gym or a church or, you know, anything.
You divide that over, like, you live 80 years, let's say, it's nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, exactly. Some change. And like I've had debates with people in the past where I'm like, you know, that money comes back to you if you know what you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I don't mean this I do not mean this in a negative way. I mean this in an absolutely positive way. The Church of Satan membership is very supportive of each other, even though we're not a community, even though we're not a congregational religion, in the sense that if you release something, like if you're an artist or you're a musician or something like that, they will support you. They will help you out, and they will buy your album, they will buy your painting or whatever. One book can make back your entire admission fee if you release it within the ranks of the COS. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's not that much money.
as long as the book's good.
Right.
Right.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I wouldn't expect...
We're not going to go there.
Bad, no.
And again. So,
In 1966, Anton LaVey created the Church of Satan, marking the beginning of the Age of Fire and Year One Anno Satanas. In 1969, he published The Satanic Bible, codifying Satanism as a religion, the first time it's been done in human history.
In the name of Satan, ruler of the earth, king of hell, come forth from the pit, bestow the blessings of hell upon us. For we are your children, and we invoke thee this night.
In 2001, I was appointed High Priest of the Church of Satan. In 2007, I published the Satanic Scriptures, further defining and expanding on Satanic philosophy and greater magic ritual.
Hail Satan, full of might!
Hail Satan, full of might!
Our allegiance is with thee! Cursed are they, the God adorers, and cursed are the worshippers of the Nazarene eunuch.
For the past 50 years, the Church of Satan has stood as the sole organization to define and defend Satanism as a religion. And though pretenders to the infernal throne have come and gone, we have stood the test of time and will into the future. Visit churchofsatan.com for more information and read the Satanic Bible and the Satanic Scriptures. Knowledge is the solution for ignorance. Hail Satan!
Hail Satan! Hail Satan!
This is Reverend Gene, the host of Vox Satane, exclusively on Radio Free Satan. Join me every week as we indulge in the classical side of music spanning the past 1,000 years. Vox Satane has already featured over 700 composers covering medieval, baroque, classical, romantic, and contemporary music, including chant, choral, opera, keyboard, and orchestral music, with composers ranging from Gluck to Gilmore, Bach to Bellavance, Talis to Taverner, and Paganini to Pärt. Get your weekly recommended dose of classical music right here on Vox Satane, only on Radio Free Satan, with me, Reverend Gene. Hail Satan!
I used to flip through one television station after another, disgusted by what was supposed to pass for comedy. Seeing all of those terrible, predictable comedians made me sad, and it made me shake in my seat. I thought it was the early signs of restless leg syndrome combined with clinical depression. So I went to see my doctor. It turned out that I just needed to listen to better comedy. That's when my doctor recommended The Devil's Mischief on Radio Free Satan.
The Devil's Mischief is a one-hour dosage of comedy and novelty that's made for you, not for the masses. After a decade of biased research, The Devil's Mischief has been clinically proven to be effective at inducing laughter and whimsical feelings in many listeners.
I can finally laugh again.
You don't need a prescription to listen to The Devil's Mischief. You don't even need to visit a pharmacy. That's because The Devil's Mischief is not a pill. It's not a syrup. It's not a spray, a cream, or even a suppository. It's a podcast.
All I need is a connection to the internet.
To learn all you need to know to listen to The Devil's Mischief, visit the official website, devilsmischief.com.
Whether you like to listen to podcasts in your web browser, download an episode directly, or subscribe to podcasts with iTunes, The Devil's Mischief can help.
Side effects may include side-splitting, gut-busting, knee slaps, and slapstick. Some listeners have reported being in stitches, with gags, or finding it to be a riot. Do not listen to The Devil's Mischief while drinking a beverage. Ask your doctor if The Devil's Mischief is right for you.
Or don't. Why should you have to pay that stupid copay for a doctor's visit?
Listen to The Devil's Mischief on RadioFreeSatan.com.
Come with me, Warlock Jeff Ivins, for a time trip back to the 1980s on the Metro. I play synth pop and other hits from the decades of indulgence, only on RadioFreeSatan.com.
Attention iTunes users, if you like this show and other programs from Radio Free Satan, then please take a moment to look us up on iTunes to rate and comment on the program. You can also do the same on Stitcher.com. Look up this program on Stitcher.com, rate it, and give us a review. And that's if you like the show, of course, you know, that you want to give it 5 stars and a good review. Not, you know, give it 1 star and say a bunch of mean things. But hey, if you want to do that, then I'm sure there are a bunch of Christian podcasts on iTunes that you could do that on. Anyway, thank you for your support of RadioFreeSatan.com. And now back to the program.
How did going through undergraduate and then graduate school, and we'll get to the military in a minute, but how did going through undergraduate and then graduate school, how did being a Satanist kind of color your perception of what was going on around you, how you interacted with other people in that environment?
That's a good question. I think it made me very careful about who I made friends with in college. I had only a handful of people in my life know that I'm a Satanist, so it's not like I was like telling every new friend I made that I was or anything. Like my girlfriend at the time knew, and like one other friend, and that was it. But as far as the way it affected my experience, a lot of it is just the personal motivation and discipline that I felt like that as like an 18-year-old joining the church and then rereading satanic books and everything increased my own motivation and discipline in this like weird religious way, and it was like something I felt like I'd been missing in my life before that.
Definitely. Yeah, so I just totally
my focus on studying, working out, and all that got a lot better the more I like wore a Baphomet and like read about other Satanists and everything. It's interesting.
So let's transfer that to the military. How does that affect, well, I guess both the ROTC experience and the military in general, how has that kind of colored that interaction? Obviously, I'm sure you're keeping that close to your breast, but how is it affecting you as a soldier, determining how you're going to interact with others and whatnot?
One big concept, the whole responsibility to the responsible concept, has proven very important to me in the military, like all from basic camp all the way till now. That whole idea of just like being accountable for what you're supposed to be accountable on, because not just yourself, but like other people are depending on you for it.
Yeah.
It made sense to me. And like, if you want to hold a higher rank of like being a commissioned officer, there's the much more responsibility that comes with that prestige and like respect you're granted by that, that you have to live up to by actually preparing your subordinates to be able to execute the tasks that you need them to execute. Right. Mm-hmm. So like staying on top of your own stuff to set as a good example and prepare them is really all ties to me with responsibility to the responsible.
Yeah, that's very true. I've often said that in the past as well. It's one of the few things, even down to just the, on your worst day in the military, the idea of responsibility, the responsible can remind you that you signed up for this shit and you have a duty to see it through.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, I mean, that's the worst case scenario. But yeah, I like how you kind of convert that into talking about, you know, officer leadership and whatnot. Because, I mean, let's face it, like you said, the Army is the biggest branch out there, which means it has a lot of diverse places you can go in it, you know, with your career and whatnot. But with that comes a lot more people, and with a lot more people, shit gets fucked up. And I know that leadership in the Army has been suffering for quite a long time, since 9/11, I'd say, at least, you know. So the idea that we always used to joke, you know, rank has its privilege in the military, and it does. But at the same time, rank also has its responsibility, and that's a heavy responsibility.
A lot of the responsibility's gone out the shitter.
Yeah, and you know, like you said, it's not just duty, you know, your job that you have to focus on, but it's the lives of people who are looking to you and counting on you. So yeah, that's a very interesting perspective on that.
Next.
Officers are, to a certain extent, politicians in their career, because they have to they have to tread that, you know, thread that needle between being a soldier and being a politician. Has Satanism and any aspects of Satanism, say like lesser magic or anything like that, has that assisted you in doing that, or are you still kind of figuring that those waters out?
Lesser magic, definitely. The very first, just such a basic thing in the military, just the first thing of that is like having your appearance be like immaculate as much as possible when you're in uniform. Being in front of formation, just having all the little strings on your uniform be cut and burned, and all that stuff being perfect.
Yeah.
And customs and courtesies, all that, I think. And then going more detailed than that is knowing how to play the role of being the platoon leader while also trying to think of how to phrase this, also being like a real person to your subordinates as well, without going so far that you become like too chummy with them.
Yeah. Right, right.
And that's that's very all much lesser magic in action to just have the control of yourself and situational awareness to thread that very fine needle.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah. I didn't think about that. Cause I've led a few, like, so I was an E5 when I got out. But the most people I've ever had have been in charge of in the military. Obviously my civilian career is a whole other thing, but in the military, the most people I ever stand in front of were about 7 to 9, give or take. Mm-hmm. But as a young officer, you're standing up there in front of, what, 50 to 100 with a platoon?
Right.
Staring,
60, generally.
Staring back at you, waiting for you to say whatever it is that they need to hear, you know?
Hey, LT, I came in on the late call, and this has probably already been answered. You went through, for your officer, through ROTC, or were you enlisted prior? Or
just straight through ROTC.
Okay. All right. Well, it probably was answered already. I just was trying to...
Well, that's what happens when you have a stroking accident.
That's what happens when you have a wife and kids and you got to go to the fucking store.
Oh,
and you forget, which day it is.
Oh,
it's my fault. I forgot it was Thursday today.
Responsibility to the responsible.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
We just had this conversation. So, let's kind of reverse engineer that now. You're a currently serving officer in the military, and a lot of us were members of the Church of Satan when we were in the military, but how do you feel that that role applies to the Church of Satan? Do you feel like... do you feel a greater sense of responsibility to the organization, or is it still a very personal thing for you and this is just what you happen to do for a job kind of thing?
Pretty much just a personal thing for me. I definitely don't want to ever make the Church of Satan look bad by my example, but sure. As far as I've gone, like, I haven't really, like, you know, published anything that's about Satanism or run a podcast or an event or anything like that. So I don't feel like I've done anything to, like, and I'm still just the rank of Satanist. Like, I'm not like a warlock or anything. So I don't feel like I've done anything to earn like a higher leadership potential within the church and the responsibility that, that comes with it. So for me, it's really is pretty much a personal thing and like connecting with the specific other members that I actually have reason to connect with.
I'm going to go out on a far limb and say that's probably a good thing. Yeah. That you consider it in that light, you know?
Well, I was just going to say, LT, you know, ranks here are not like ranks in the military. Ranks here in the COS are honorariums. You are honored with that. Just because Jeff's a warlock and you and I are Satanists, we're not looking up at him like he's the sergeant, you know, or
no, but right, we have this awesome leader. Warlocks are sexy mug.
Oh, yeah. Nice. but the pentagram needs to be flipped over.
Yeah, that was it was Sean Poirier's design. So.
Yeah. I had more to my point. Don't ever allow something, LT, that you're going to put out. Don't ever let that hold you back. You always have the right to put a disclaimer on there. Even though I am an active member of the Church of Satan, I do not represent them directly. My comments are my own. If you put that at the bottom of whatever you're writing, the COS still reads your stuff and they say, hey, you know what? LT knows what the hell he's talking about. And, you know, so don't ever let that hold you back.
Actually, no, that's a good point. Go ahead.
Oh, what were you saying?
I was going to say, did you ever get lost on the land nav course?
I have. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Continue.
I admit I had to redo it at Bullock. I did have to do a retest. You guys ever been to Fort Leonard Wood?
No,
I have not. Lost in the woods?
That's one of the, probably the hilliest land nav course I've ever been on. That was just like scaling like near cliffs the whole time. But
that's in Missouri, right?
Missouri,
yeah. The Ozarks.
Yeah.
I can believe that. Jackson's a bitch too because you're going from clay to sand to fucking rocks to
Jackson's such a bitch. They nicknamed it Relaxin' Jackson.
Oh, fuck that.
Oh.
Let's see. They train recruiters down there. I mean, they usually train recruiters at Knox, but they train recruiters down there. They train drill sergeants down there.
Relaxing that is true. Jackson. Drill sergeant school
Relaxing
is in
Jackson.
For Jackson. So. Yeah. That's got to be a hard course, I can imagine.
It is.
So, was there ever a point now in, you know, because your training was spread out essentially over, I'd say about, what would you say, about 3 or 4 years almost that your training to become an officer was stretched out over?
For me, it was only 2 years because I came into it late and was doing an MBA. For most of my colleagues, it was either 4 or in some cases 5 years because they had engineering majors that required 5 years.
Right. So was there ever a point in that 2 years then where you were like, I fucked up. I shouldn't have done this.
No, honestly, never.
Good.
The only point where I felt anything similar to that was at basic camp the first time. So at basic camp, we didn't have the drill sergeants right away. It was just these like other NCOs from different like guard and reserve training units. But sure. Then there was like the third day there was when at like 4 a.m, drill sergeants like kicking the doors, went outside, and like when I was doing like push-ups on like gravel and had like rocks like in my hand, yeah. that was like kind of just the moment during that with like drill sergeant screaming at me and stuff. I was like, maybe I made a mistake in coming here, but that was the only moment like that.
Yeah, drill sergeants are a different breed. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I'm pretty sure none of them can talk right after they get out. You always hear them kind of half shouting and saying weird things. Yeah. Like stop the fucking madness.
I can always recognize them now. It's funny.
All right, so I do have a very important question to ask, and then yes. I'm going to turn it over to you and let you just tell us whatever stories you'd like to and whatnot. But when you were filling out your active membership application, what was your joke?
Oh. This is such a shitty answer, but I honestly don't remember, which maybe says how good my sense of humor is.
Right. Well, you know, having even if you left that question blank, it'd still be better than Jesus Saves.
Yes.
So. Was that you?
No, that was Dwayne.
Yeah, Dwayne, yeah.
Really? And we've given him nothing but shit about that ever since.
They've given me shit about that for a year.
Or more.
And I believe, well, but I mean, since we've been doing this show, yeah. I mean, I believe LT is the first officer we've had on as well, hasn't he?
Is. I mentioned at the top of the show, he's the first officer and the first, right now, the first currently serving service member we've had on the show. There are quite a few in the Legion, obviously, but we tend to not have them on for the same concerns that you expressed before we did this about, you know, there's little things like OPSEC. There's also things like politics and rank structure to go through. And a lot of people don't want to out themselves. And I totally understand that. And I'm very happy that you were willing to come on the show and give us that perspective.
And this obviously goes without saying, but like any comments I make on the whole podcast don't represent any official opinion of the U.S. Army or U.S. Army Reserve or my particular unit at all, obviously. But just to say the obvious.
I'm curious about just to kind of to put it all in context, because what we do in the Infernal Legion is, I guess you could say, the satanic version of what older, larger groups have been doing for some time, like the VFW and the American Legion and whatnot. And you're a member of the Infernal Legion, which we're very grateful for, but have you looked into joining any of the other VSOs, like the American Legion or AMVETS or anything like that? Or is that something you're saving for down the road?
I've thought about American Legion. I feel like, since I haven't done a combat deployment, I always feel weird joining, like, most veterans organizations, because I am... like in the military, but like when so many other people in there have combat deployments, I'm like, I don't know. It just makes me feel somewhat out of place in it.
It certainly does get weird at bars for guys who have never had a combat deployment. Like when we go to the canteens and stuff, because for anyone who's never been inside a VFW, it's literally a bunch of guys with beards that are way too drunk sitting around swapping war stories. And that's what we do like 24/7.
Sure.
And every now and then you'll get guys that are still active or whatever, and they'll come in and they've never deployed, or they're a slick sleeve, as we call them in the Army. And they'll come in and they just kind of, they look very awkward because it's just a bunch of old Marines and soldiers and sailors sitting around and doing shots and talking about that weird guy in Iraq that they all met, you know?
Right.
And Space Force.
No, Space Force.
Yeah.
I got to find a reason to say that in every show.
On the next episode we release this month, which will be kind of a veteran news episode, we're going to do a little talking about Space Force. So for those of you listening, make sure you tune in for that. There's been some recent Netflix developments.
Oh, did you finally get that?
I did indeed.
It was good, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's very much so. Thank you for recommending it.
Oh, so funny.
So I want to turn the floor over to you as someone who's currently serving in the U.S. Army, reserves or not, doesn't matter, in the U.S. Army, and as an officer. Is there anything specific from your perspective, from your point of view, that you would like to say or tell a story about or put out there for someone who might be just now joining the military or anything like that?
It's a good question. Let me think a second. I think that for young people, people any age that are you know, age eligible to join, I think that joining the military, whether it's the Army or any of the other branches, I think is one of the best decisions that a young person can make for themselves in their own self-development. And that's me speaking as, like, not as an officer or anything professional, but just me personally, is that the way that I've been able to develop my own discipline and what I'm able to accomplish, fight through just tolerating discomfort, basic things like that, overcoming challenges, has just improved so much as a result of the training that I've done even up to this point. And I think that a lot of, like, 18-year-olds that don't know if they're going to go to college right away this fall, who knows if that's even going to happen with the virus and everything. I think you could do way worse than joining the military for even just like a 2-year contract, just to see what you get out of it, and then college will still be there for you after. So I think it's something that I think young people in the U.S. maybe need more than ever, with how much softer life has gotten in a lot of ways compared to previous decades of U.S. history. I think is something that could really benefit a lot of individuals.
Yeah, I haven't asked a lot of our past guests this, because most of us were joined shortly after 9/11, or even finished serving before 9/11 happened. Mm-hmm. But we are in a unique situation right now in the country where we're still in an active war with Afghanistan right now, and most people seem to have forgotten about it. Did you think about that option before you went in, or was that even just like a non-issue? Like, how did that impact your decision to go through the process?
I definitely thought about it. I mean, I was like, I could die in a war if I'm in the Army, but I think for me, joining when I did in 2017, I think there is an effect where people below a certain age who are joining now don't even think about the fact that we're at war, because it's the way it's just always been for them. Mm-hmm. Like, literally for, like, the 18-year-old privates that were at Fort Leonard Wood, like, they were born, like, literally, like, after 9/11. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and I think even for me, I'm 27 now, like, I'm not, so, like, I do remember 9/11 and stuff when I was a kid, but mm-hmm. it just didn't, I don't think it makes as much of an impression on younger people, because it's just the way things have always been for them at that age.
Yeah, I'm curious. I'm sure we've got a Legionnaire somewhere that's just joined, just young enough to join. I'd love to hear their perspective on this, because there's a big difference between joining the military during a time of peace, general peace, because there's always something going on in the military, or during a full-fledged war. And I'm not sure, like, I'm not even sure my own daughter understands that we're still engaged in a war mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm. Like, we have soldiers actively deploying overseas every day and engaging in combat, and the media has other things to focus on and intentionally focuses on other things sometimes. But I do think we're living in a very unique time where the average American doesn't understand that there are people still fighting over there right now.
Yeah.
And as a reservist, that has to weigh. I would imagine, you know, because when I was in active duty, that was my life. That's what I did. I woke up, did PT, did whatever I had to do during the day, got off, went to drink. That's what I still think.
Went to Taco Tuesday.
Right?
At the NCO club.
But for a reservist, I'd imagine that might weigh a little bit heavier on you, yeah? I mean, because you're not just going to have to. Obviously, your job is secure and all that. Your civilian job is going to be secure and all that. But you're going to have to essentially uproot your entire life when you get a...
Right.
So how does that, like, do you think about that often, or is it just something you're going to deal with when it happens?
I think that's something that is a much greater burden on reservists and guard members that like have dependents. For me, where it's literally just me and I don't even have girlfriend right now, no kids or anything, the thought of being like, hey, let's, and you're gonna go to, let's just, even if it's not if it's Gitmo or Kuwait or something for 9 months, I'm like, oh yeah, sure, like that's awesome, I want to go do a deployment and like, you know, make some money personally. Right. So like I don't really worry about it that much, to be honest. If my boss told me that like we were gonna go to Gitmo a few months from now, I'd be happy about it.
Right. Is that something that I know, like, so for those of you who are not familiar with how the military works, usually in a platoon, you have your platoon sergeant and your platoon leader. And the platoon leader is an officer, the platoon sergeant is E6 or E7. Usually E7, but sometimes an E6 will fill in that role. Joes, the average enlisted guy, tends to be closer to their platoon sergeant than they are the platoon leader. However, being an officer, you have to, I'm sure, communicate with the platoon sergeant and sometimes with the Joes directly on a kind of, an emotionally intimate level. Have you heard concerns from any of them about that, or are they all handling it like true professionals?
Some of them are having real issues right now just with coronavirus affecting their jobs and families. Mm-hmm. That's a much, like, literally immediate, because especially my unit's not that far from New York City, so, like, a lot of my soldiers live, like, in New York City. So we've had, like, deaths in soldiers' families, like, literally because of coronavirus. Some of them are cops and firefighters, so they still work during it, but a lot of people are in other various civilian jobs where they've been out of work for months. Yeah. So that's really, honestly, for them, going on a deployment would be financially better than the situation right now. Unfortunately, that's been pretty tough on us, yeah.
Interesting. I hadn't even considered that. They'll probably save their pay, right. Their bank accounts in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Well, AT is coming up soon.
That's true, yeah.
Yes.
AT's coming up soon, so.
Interesting. Well, I guess I'll ask one final question.
Sure.
And this is just for, it's going to tie in, like I was saying earlier, with our news show that's coming later in the month. With all the current happenings in the world between the pandemic and then the protests and things like that are occurring, and you especially being an MP, how do you feel about being activated to do something on American soil? And, you know, full disclosure, again, this is not the opinions of the Church of Satan, the Infernal Legion, or the United States Army. Just you as an individual, is that something that concerns you, or is it something that you're just like, okay, if this is what happens, I'm going to have to do it, you know?
I would have some discomfort about it. Absolutely, you know, well, let me think how to phrase this properly. I would have.
Yeah, I know it's a loaded question. I apologize for that.
It's our question because it's, yeah, it really gets to the heart of like the role of the U.S. military as compared to civilian police, and then also especially my role as like a commissioned officer where that's coming from the U.S. Congress and president.
Right.
But I would definitely have. It's an uncomfortable thought to be deployed on U.S. soil, I think. Like, if you look back at the history of, like, the L.A. riots.
Yeah.
And some of what happened there with how directly, like, Marines were involved in everything.
Mm-hmm.
That should illustrate well why I would have some discomfort about it.
Certainly, yeah. Yeah, I totally understand that.
You can even see the most recent stories, the four-star general that was walking with the president from the White House through the park to the church. He as recently as today said that he should have taken off his uniform if he was walking with the president over there because he just feels bad about it.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like sometimes that decision, because you really are, when you're weighing your options in that position as a soldier of any rank, but especially as an officer, I think that there comes the time where you have to question. I know I certainly question sometimes in combat, and I always came out on the side that I came out on. But you have a duty and a responsibility and an obligation not only to follow orders, but to disobey unlawful orders.
Exactly.
And that decision has to weigh so much heavier on an officer than it does on an enlisted, you know, like an E4 or below. And not just in this. I know we started talking about the protests and stuff, so I'm going to like kind of push that aside. But in general, is that something you've considered? Like, have you, in your own mind, and you don't have to tell us what it is, but in your own mind, have you decided on a point where you would not order your soldiers to do something that was over this line, let's say, whatever that line may be?
Yeah, I've thought about it. I consider that to be part of the duties of an officer, and it is for any soldier to disobey orders that are outright unlawful, like in like war crimes category. It is something that does weigh extra heavily on officers as being,
because you're the ones giving us the orders to do it.
Right. Yeah. Right. And the example, the example that I would set by either doing it or not doing whatever it is, aside from recent events, whatever it
sure,
is.
Yeah, that's what
doing,
I said. We're
that. Doing it or not sets a much, obviously just sets a much bigger example than like an E4, you know, not doing whatever it is, right? People will, across the army would look to like, oh, this lieutenant or captain went ahead with it, so it's what we're doing, right? So that, and I think that is part of there's like, and we talked in ROTC, we talked about this, about some of the books we read looking at some of the war crimes committed, even in like recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the responsibility on commanders for that. That there is that whole very interesting concept that you have a duty to not obey orders that are outright criminal,
which is an extremely modern concept. Like in right. terms of human history.
Yeah.
I am in no way, because I usually get into this and then I get into it with Lou.
Nah, Jesus fucking Christ.
There we go.
How do you justify a unlawful order from the commander in chief? Mm. Or how do you?
God damn it, Dwayne!
How do you do it? I am in no way taking a political side on it.
I'm going to jump in, and of course, Greg, you can answer. When I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm going to jump in and just say that I think that an unlawful order coming from anyone that outranks you, from the commander in chief all the way down to your, I believe you're a second lieutenant, so from your first lieutenant. Mm-hmm. Would be treated with the same gravity. Because you're right. When you're talking about unlawful orders, you're talking about straight up war crimes kind of stuff. So it doesn't matter if, you know, Joe Blow, who graduated college a year before me or whatever, or the president of the United States was the one telling me to do some fucked up shit. If it's fucked up shit, it's fucked up shit.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, it's an extremely difficult concept, because normally disobeying orders is treason in general.
Yeah.
There's a very good chance of you going to prison either way, and then hopefully ending up being on the right side of history and getting vindicated after the fact, but having to put up with the fact that you may be arrested immediately for it. You know, it's a very interesting concept to be kind of obeying the greater good than even orders that are specifically unlawful orders. It's a very interesting, difficult concept that I hope I don't have to ever actually like address in real life in my career, but who knows?
If history has shown us anything, nine times, you'll probably have a wonderful career with no problem. Mm-hmm. But it's always something I've wanted to ask an officer, and unfortunately, the officers who I can still consider friends that I served with have long forgotten about that in a haze of booze. So they don't have a good answer for me. But it's something I wanted to ask you, because you're currently serving, and specifically serving as an MP. because your job would put you on the front lines of anything in America that were to go down. So have you heard any opinions? And obviously, I'm not asking you to dime anybody out, but have you heard any opinions from your Joes about that? Like, how are they as divided as the nation seems, or are they still one team, one fight? We're focused on doing our mission.
I think they are honestly very united as far as being in uniform, being in the Army, one team, one fight. Very diverse group of young people, the Joes are, being mostly between ages like 18 and 22. They're even a little bit of like a different generation than me, I guess, but like some of them actually do have combat deployments, and like, yeah, I think they are very maybe they have, people have different political opinions and
sure,
stuff,
yeah, anyway, sure.
But I do think they do very genuinely like know that you keep that kind of stuff to yourself when you're in uniform, and that we have a specific job to do related to the Army that transcends those broader politics of the society. Very important to me. I think they do get the idea that we have to remain apolitical.
That's one thing. That was one line. Like, I was a young kid, and I came from being an anarchist punk to being a soldier, which is a night and day difference. But that was one thing I always took very, very seriously, and it's something that still carries with me to this day, that when you have your uniform on, that's not a time to discuss politics. It's not a time to make a statement. It's not a time to do anything. That the uniform is, in a sense, and I'm using this in a very broad sense because we are all Satanists here, it's sacred. It represents something, and by wearing it, you are representing that thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you don't have the luxury of voicing an opinion when you're wearing it. So I think that's an important thing, and hopefully, and maybe this will find some ears that have been kind of torn on this whole thing the whole time, and explain why we, as the Infernal Legion, have not made any public statements about the things that are happening right now, because our job is to serve and support our veterans of the United States Armed Forces and some global armed forces that have joined recently. We are not here to make political statements about anything. We're here to support and protect them from whatever the government may do to limit their benefits or anything of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, being that you're an officer, it's something I wanted to bring up with you because I wanted to get a kind of current take on the morale of the troops, as it were.
No, and that's something I want to say too related to that is, like, I see a lot of older people bashing millennials and now Gen Z quite often.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's some of the same people that also a lot of them didn't serve, but like they'll be the same people that are very like pro military and like support our troops and stuff. And I'm just to that kind of sentiment, those same people, I'm like, you do realize that the vast majority of people in the U.S. military are, like, Gen Zers that are between
right.
the ages of, like, 18 and 23. Like, they're the same people. They come from this society.
The overwhelming majority.
Right.
Yeah.
You have a base, almost, like, a handful of people that are, you know, 50s and older. Like, it's just a pyramid of, like, the ages are very, very young in the military.
Yeah.
So it's just to point out that, yeah, though they are some of, like, the best of the best of their generation that are in the military, and that's always who the military has come from, you know?
Right. War is a young man's
American
game.
Societies, people also have, like, American society declining, and young people are entitled this and that, which there's some truth to some of that, but it's also, like, there are still tens of thousands of them that are signing up and serving in the military and would be ready to deploy just as previous generations have been. So I just like to put that out there. I have some very good soldiers in my unit.
That's awesome. I'm really glad to hear that too. I know that once you have your DD214 blanket, you tend to think that the military has become pussified. Once you're out, you think the military is just a bunch of jokers that can't do anything anymore, yada, yada, yada. It's always that the next generation had it easier than I did. And I don't necessarily think that's true. There are certainly different ways that the military evolves, training evolves, and things of that nature. And there are certainly things that younger generations may not have to go through that older generations did, but at the same time, it's still the military. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's been great to have you on the show. It's been great to hear your perspective. Thank you first and foremost for your service. Thank you for choosing to do it at a very difficult time. And that's something that should never go unmentioned. But also thank you for coming on here and giving your perspective to us as someone who's currently serving and as an officer, because we don't have many of those in the Legion.
No.
Well, thank you guys for having me on, and thank all of you for your service as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. All right, so approximately 2 weeks, we will be doing a news broadcast. And when I say news, I want to be very clear, we're still not talking about fucking politics. But we've had, over the last year that we've been doing this podcast, well, close to a year that we've been doing this podcast, we have learned that there is an interest in both hearing more from our Wicked Warriors of the Month, and also hearing more about what's happening in the military with veterans news and military news and things of that nature. So we're going to divide these up from now on. We're going to have two shows a month, one focused specifically on our Wicked Warrior of the Month and one focused specifically on what's happening in the world of the military and the world of veterans. So look forward to that in about, give or take, about 2 weeks. It will be this month. But in the meantime, Lieutenant Greg Willingson, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for your service. And until we can talk again, hail Satan.
Hail Satan.
Hail Satan. Veteran Suicide Hotline. Phone number is 1-800-273-8255. 1-800-273-TALK. And as soon as you dial that, you press number one. Also, you can text to 838-255 for more information, but it is just as effective as chat. Support is free, confidential, and available 24/7. It is available to all servicemen and women, active and inactive, guard or reserve, and available to veterans, family members as well.